Do you have your tickets yet? This is officially going to be the shortest ad in Living Church podcast history. Quick reminder to get your tickets for the Awe and Presence Conference if you don't have them yet. We're going to explore what it means to worship with the church of the past, what the body does in worship, how liturgy works, understanding the story we're in, and George Herbert on prayer. What could get better than that? Go to livingchurch.org/events for more info and to register, or click the link in the show notes today. I would love to see you in St. Louis.
So that's what I've learned from Lutheran Episcopal relationships. Sometimes, as much as we like to focus on the big national stuff, the real strength is when it's on the ground, when it's in the church, when it's in the local community. And that is just a blessing when it happens.
The Living Church, serving the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion since 1878. Welcome to the Living Church podcast. Welcome back, podcast listeners. What hath Martin Luther to do with Thomas Cranmer? Many of you may know that the Church of England, and thus the Anglican Communion, and thus along the line, the Episcopal Church, go back to the Reformation. You might be a church nerd, so you might even know how it goes back to the Reformation and some of the history there. Well, today we're going to go into this very spicy time in history, the Reformation, but we're going to take a little sidetrack. We're going to go into a fascinating shared history between Anglicans and Lutherans. These two Reformation-born groups were not only finding their little baby feet at the same time, they were also interested in one another from fairly early on. This wasn't just mutual appreciation of one another's beer brewing techniques, though I'm sure that probably came in there somewhere. Anglican-Lutheran dialogues go back to 1536, actually. We'll also be learning what it means to be Lutheran. We're just going to learn about the Lutherans and what Anglicans and Lutherans can continue to learn from each other today. So, why are we talking about the Lutherans? Well, today we are continuing a series on full communion partners with the Episcopal Church. Who are they? What are they doing? Why do I care? Why do you care? Basically, a full communion partner with the Episcopal Church is this, and this comes from the Episcopal Church website, quote, a relation between distinct churches in which each recognizes the other as a Catholic and apostolic church holding the essentials of the Christian faith, unquote. But this mutual recognition is not just informal. This is not just a big Christian hug-in, although those are great. Those are wonderful. These are also hard-won relationships between diverse Christian bodies on a formal and a structural level as well, with a fullness of shared faith, the exchangeability of ministers, and a full sharing of the sacraments. And we'll continue to talk about some of that today. So in other words, this is a commitment to visible unity, the visible unity of God's people at worship and in life and ministry together. Now, you can warm up to this conversation and other conversations that are going to be coming by listening to my interview with Christopher Wells on Who Cares About Communion? That's episode 129, and we talk about visible unity and why we believe here at TLC that it matters so much. Our guide today into this full communion partner convo used to be a park ranger, so he's pretty good at guiding. And that is Lutheran bishop, Reformation scholar, and motorcycle man, the Most Reverend Matthew Riegel. Matthew is bishop of the West Virginia Western Maryland Synod in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. As a scholar, his primary research interest is the sanctification of, get this, ecclesiastical politics. Matthew serves on the West Virginia Council of Churches Civic Life and Faith Task Force. And as I said in a previous life, he's worked as a park ranger. We'll talk a bit about that today. We'll also talk about Lutheran distinctives, how politics can be a way of holiness, how Henry VIII was asked to sign the Augsburg Confession, and why the Lutherans are asking for an 8th ecumenical council, which might just put them out of a job. Now, find your most ornate, ridiculously large stein, fill it with a warm or cold beverage of your choice, and get ready to very strongly disagree about something in German. Just kidding. Well, maybe. In either case, We hope you enjoy the conversation. Matthew, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, I know from your bio that in another life, you worked for the National Park Service. You were also an EMT. And I'm curious, does working in a national park have anything in common with being a pastor?
I wasn't one of the park rangers who's out in the far backwoods doing anything like that. I was always worked at history sites. So I'm the guide at Valley Forge, and I'm the guide at Gettysburg and stuff. And so our job is to translate for the public a story that they don't know about a time they're not familiar with, so that it becomes something they can appropriate for themselves and make sense of who they are, that it becomes their story as well. And really, when you stop and think about it, that is the preaching and teaching task in the church. So, yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I sometimes wonder if I could get rid of my vestments and put my park ranger hat on.
Well, you could, I suppose, especially if it's like a tri-corner hat and like you're wearing gaiters or something like that. But I mean, that's an even better answer than I expected. It is interesting to think of part of the work of a minister as being a historical reenactor. Well, I brought you here today, Matthew, because the Episcopal Church is a full communion partner with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. And I've been interested in doing a series on the podcast with each of the Episcopal Church's full communion partners. So I've got someone from the Church of Sweden lined up. I've got some Moravians lined up, and we'll go along the line. I want to learn, you know, what does the Episcopal Church have in common with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, what our relationship looks like, what we might learn today going forward together in some of the challenges of our times. So first, I want to ask you, for those who may not know much about the Lutheran Church or what it means to be Lutheran, I certainly don't. I had to do some research before coming to this conversation today. Can you share with us maybe a top three Lutheran distinctives? Like, how can I pick a Lutheran out in a crowd?
Oh, that's a great question. The answer that you might get to that question will depend upon which Lutheran you ask, because a distinctive is in itself a contextual question. What might be a distinctive in one place is not necessarily a distinctive in another place. What's a distinctive in one time is not going to be a distinctive in another time. So you're going to have to deal with the fact that Lutherans themselves have to grapple with this all the time, because we're in different situations around the world, and we have different histories. Just within the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, which is the body I'm a member of, if you counted up all the predecessor Lutheran bodies that form it, it's over 130.
Wow.
And so each of those different groups had their own histories, and they came from different parts of the world at different time periods. So that complicates it.
Could I actually already point out that this is something that's going to be different from the Episcopal Church? Because you just said that the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America is made up of over 100 different Lutheran groups. So this is a product of different Lutheran groups that are separate, coming together in one fold. And the Episcopal Church has the experience of being part of the Anglican Communion, which has had some joinings, certainly knows it, you know, its share of joinings, but also right now is in a particularly, you know, fractured and fractious time. And when I narrate the history of, you know, what is the Episcopal Church, people ask me, and I find myself sharing a history of splittings more than a history of joinings. So I think already this is a distinctive vis-a-vis the Episcopal Church or the Anglican Communion. Little Lutheran groups said, we need to get our act together. Let's get together and form bodies. Whereas we're a body that finds that we're having a hard time staying together. So that's already one that I think people would be really interested in.
Yeah. And thanks for pointing that out. I hadn't even thought of that, but I think that's dead on the mark. And one of the reasons, when I say 130 different groups, there were only three Lutheran bodies that formed the ELCA, and they were the American Lutheran Church, Lutheran Church in America, and the Association of Evangelical Lutheran Churches. But each of them were themselves mergers, except for the AELC. Oh. That was a split.
Okay.
So the AELC was a split from the Missouri Synod, But the other two were mergers of mergers of mergers of mergers.
Wow.
The first Lutherans in America, in the continental United States, were the Swedes. Mm. And they were from the Church of Sweden. But then the Germans came over. But they never owned a colony, so there was never any state church here. And you have successive waves of immigrants coming from each of their own different national Lutheran church bodies. And then they come at different times. So just because my ancestors are German Lutheran immigrants who came over in the 1730s, doesn't mean they have anything really in common with the Germans who came in 1848.
Yeah.
And then the Germans who came in the interwar period. So they came as their own groups. They formed their own polities. Unlike the Episcopal Church, the Roman Catholic Church, where in a sense the diocese leads the way, mm-hmm. for most American Lutherans, congregations existed before there was ever a diocese. And they formed what we call synodical polity. Congregations came together to form the synods, the equivalent of the diocese, because there was utility in that. And that's very different than the other way around. It mm-hmm. actually goes to a fundamental difference between us and what is the ecclesia localis, what is the local church. And for Lutherans, the local church is the congregation. But really, out of the Episcopal Roman Catholic tradition, the local church is the diocese. And the pastor of the local church is the bishop. And for us, the bishop is not the pastor of all these congregations, but is somebody elected from the ground up. So you have a fundamental difference in the direction of polity.
Yeah, yeah. That is really interesting. Is there, in what way would you say that that difference in polity influences something about the culture of either church that, you know, the average parishioner might feel or understand?
Oh, I think it's huge. You can never divorce that from other social forces, but I don't think there is near the notion of deference to a bishop.
So you guys don't kiss their feet?
No, and they won't kiss my ring. It's significantly different. And I've sensed this and I've experienced this as I've worked with Episcopalians, where I've seen a much different attitude toward bishops and how one acts toward the bishop. And I'm okay with the Lutheran model. I'm not lusting after the Episcopalian model on that, but it is a different culture. I think it also goes to questions about how property ownership works and how control and authority works. For instance, during the pandemic, my Episcopal counterpart called me and said, you know, we've got to provide a unified front here and close down all of our congregations. And I had to say to him, well, I don't have that authority. And he was caught off guard. And sort of the dialogue, you don't? I said, no, our polity's built this way. Our congregations control themselves entirely. I can't walk in and say, you're done, you're closed. I can't do that. And his comment was, wow, we are really different. That's in the weeds. We think we're so similar in some ways, and we are. And then you have these areas, especially in polity, where there's significant differences.
Yeah. You've done a lot of work in, I think what I read in your bio was the sanctification of ecclesial polity or ecclesial politics. And I just found that really fascinating and really beautiful, actually, if it means what I think it means. I just wonder, as you're exploring what it means to have ecclesial policies and politics that are more and more sanctified, is that for you influenced in any way by your experience with other Christian groups? Does that question make sense? So as you're experiencing the cultures and the ways of other Christian groups, is there anything about them that helps you to understand how your own tradition can be more sanctified in its polities and politics?
Okay, so that was my STM project. And I was looking at it specifically in a very narrow Lutheran lens intentionally. I mean, if I were to pick that up again, I might look more broadly. But you know how it is when you're doing an academic project, you got to set parameters.
Yeah, you got to focus.
And my primary concern there was not just how do we do our church politics in ways that are consistent with sanctification, but how is it that by actually doing the church politics, we become sanctified? How is politics within the church a medium and a means to sanctification, both individually and corporately? And my reason for that was experience, looking at congregations, looking at my own home congregation and friends who didn't want to get involved in the church politics because it didn't seem nice. It didn't seem holy enough. It seemed nasty. And church politics are oftentimes nasty. We'll just own that. But they were trying to, I think, maintain their holiness and be good Christians and not recognizing that by absenting themselves from the political mechanisms of the church, if all the good people leave church politics, who's left to do it?
Yeah.
Okay. So this way of thinking about the politics of the church as a place in which we can actually grow in sanctification is not off the mark, I think. I mean, think about it. You and I, we have a human relationship. It's in that human relationship that you learn patience and put up with me because I'm vexing and problematic. And all that is growth in holiness. And that's part of it. There's also ways in which if I'm misbehaving, if you chastise me, if you rebuke me, you're helping me in sanctification as well. Because unless you rebuke me, I'm just going to remain the mass of horror that I am.
Yeah. Tolerance and rebuke. That would make an entire other incredible podcast conversation. We talk a lot on the podcast and also in Episcopal circles that are interested in church unity. People talk about friendship, bridge building, communion across difference. I haven't heard much conversation about rebuke or mutual rebuke and that being also part of this process of sanctification, church unity, conversation across difference. Rebuke is difficult, but you've just reminded me that it's necessary. And I wish that I heard more conversation about that as well.
Well, one of the places you would find it is if you look at the ecumenical dialogues that lead to full communion, one of the marks of full communion is supposed to be mutual affirmation and admonition.
Mm.
And so as we live into these full communion agreements, the question I constantly ask is, so I see we're doing really well with affirmation. How are we doing with the admonition?
Yeah.
You know? Because that's part of our walk together. Our walk together is never a mutual congratulatory society. It's to provoke one another to good works. And that sometimes requires rebuke.
Yeah. Yeah. I was reminded the other day, this scripture came up, provoking one another to good works. And the preacher emphasized the word provoke. And he said, we're very good at provoking one another on social media. We're very good at provoking one another in other kinds of conversations, political conversations, in our marriages, in children and parents. We're very good at provoking one another. So when it comes to church relationships and our brothers and sisters in Christ and church unity and our faithfulness in these relationships, let's provoke. Let's provoke one another on to good works. So I've heard that twice now in a short space of time. So it's interesting. I wonder, Matthew, if we could, I bet you that if we move a little bit into the history of Anglican-Lutheran interactions, going way back to the very beginning, when Lutheranism mm-hmm. was a baby and Anglicanism was a little baby, and they were there together at the Reformation. I bet that this question of distinctives will continue to unfold through this mm-hmm. question. You've done a lot with history, particularly in the Reformation period. So when Lutherans and Anglicans first came out of the Reformation, they, from the beginning, were taking different paths structurally in polity and in theological emphases to some extent. Can you tell us some about that period in history? In the beginning, for example, were they parallel movements? Did they interact with each other from the beginning? Was there some sense of competition there? Did they support each other in some way or sort of just ignore each other for a while and do their own thing? What was that relationship like in the beginning? How were they viewing each other when they were new?
That's a fantastic question. I sometimes am amazed that anything came about between the what would be called the English Reformation and the German Reformation. Because Henry, of course, before the English Reformation got off, published a rather vitriolic tract against Luther in defense of the seven sacraments. So, but that was before it was the Church of England. Lutheranism didn't start in a church. It started in the university. The leader of it was a university professor. And because it was an academic movement, its primary channels of communication were really along academic circulation, if you will. even the 95 Theses was an invitation to an academic debate. So as stuff is being published, who's picking up? Who's reading it? Well, people who are reading it are scholars themselves or university students. And all of a sudden, this hot new book shows up in a bookstore in England, and a university student picks it up and starts reading it. And what do you think they do when they find the hot new book? They get together at the pub, and they start reading it together and arguing about it. More and more people look at it. It gets exciting. And then some of those students decide they actually want to go to Wittenberg and study.
And so, and what book is this? Is this the 95 Theses that were published as a book?
Oh, it's a bunch of different things. The 95 Theses got broad circulation. Luther and Erasmus's debates on the will, on the bondage of the will and the freedom of the will, that's flying all over the place. And you got to remember, Erasmus was teaching in England. So now you've got two competing theologians publishing directly competing works that are pointed at each other, where they're insulting them in the work, each other in the works and everything. And you know how students are. God, you love it when your faculty fight. It's a show. and this percolates throughout the system. And then some say, well, I'm going to go take a semester in Wittenberg. And they cross the ocean. It was actually a monograph published in the late 1800s, I think it was, which a historian tried to identify all the English students who studied at Wittenberg University. So they're coming over to study. They're going back to England. You have Cranmer marrying Osiander's niece or daughter. So it even becomes familial connections. And so these Englishmen are bringing the stuff they're learning from Wittenberg back to England itself. That's going to be something that helps propel the English Reformation to where you finally get the Act of Supremacy. So there's that theological undercurrent. Some of us like to say that the English Reformation really started out as a Lutheran Reformation in the beginning, but the Lutheran element of it became suppressed by the Calvinist element of it. And because there's more than one Reformation that's going on, and at this point, it's like wide open field, and people are mixing and matching theologies and stuff like that. So the Lutheran strain sort of gets suppressed, the Calvinist strain ascends. Does that make sense?
I think so. And what would you say, when you say the Lutheran strain, what would be like a distinctive of the Lutheran strain and then a distinctive of the Calvinist strain? Do you see what I mean? Like, what would be the character that then would be suppressed so that the character of this other movement became more dominant in the early English Reformation?
Issues related to sacramentology, there'd be issues related to ecclesiastical polity, issues related to the relationship with the state. There's going to be questions about sanctification. There's lots of little things. And admittedly, some of them are very nuanced differences.
Sure.
But those nuanced differences are perfect for the academy.
Is there one in particular that you could name that's less nuanced? Maybe a sacramental difference, like approaching the Eucharist.
I might have Calvinist friends who would disagree with this, but we'll try it on for size. I would describe the Lutheran reaction to Roman Catholic theology on the Eucharist and the Calvinist reaction to Roman Catholic theology as taking two different approaches to resolve what they thought were the same problem. And the Lutheran approach is going to emphasize imminence, that Christ is here and Christ is present, and sort of there's almost a tangibility about it without it being transubstantiation. Whereas the Calvinists became much more concerned about preserving divine sovereignty, that we can't manipulate God, that we're not in charge of this, that there's no hocus corpus meum going on, there's no hocus pocus going on. And those two different approaches, the imminence approach versus a sovereignty approach, really affect how you play with some other details in the sacrament. And I think ultimately the Church of England resolved it in their own way, but these are competing visions that are running side by side for a while.
Yeah.
And I don't know that either the Lutheran or the Roman Catholic side won in the end. I think there's ultimately a distinctive Episcopalian approach or an Anglican approach, but you can see the fingerprints of the other approaches on it.
Yeah, you can see the fingerprints of a lot of approaches in Anglican theology. For sure.
And one of the things, as we look at any of these things, we need to own that Lutheranism evolves. We go through an entire scholastic period for 300 years. Then we have the movement of Pietism. And then, of course, we all get hit with the Enlightenment. Calvinism evolves as well. They go through the Synod of Dort and the Arminian crisis. And the Church of England, you know, goes through, well, in its early days, you had bishops getting executed and priests getting executed depending on who got Henry's ear at any given time. So you have this vacillation between the more Catholicizing wings and the more Protestant wings. As a historian, I love looking at the 16th century, but I also have to recognize that we're not only creatures of the 16th century, we're creatures of everything else in between.
Yeah.
And that can both complicate and vivify dialogue at the same time. The big things for Lutheran Church of England relationships early on, the Wittenberg Articles of 1536 are really significant. A team of theologians, it was Fox, Heath, and Barnes, who came to Wittenberg, and they met with Luther and Melanchthon, Krusacher and Bugenhagen, and a couple others, and they drafted a common theological statement, the Wittenberg Articles. It was heavily based upon the Augsburg Confession, the Apology of the Loci Communis. And they brought that back to England to see if it could get ratified by the Church of England. It never did.
What was the goal, Matthew, of that? Was that a first ecumenical dialogue or to join the churches?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was the first Lutheran Anglican ecumenical dialogue was the Wittenberg Articles of 1536. And no, they weren't looking at fusing the churches. At this point, they're very clearly national churches, if you will. But it's looking at, can we be on the same page together? They're in the middle of a complex geopolitical situation. So getting on the same page is important for other things as well. Like I said, the Wittenberg Articles were not ratified by England, but they did really serve as the base for the 10 Articles. And then later on, the 10 Articles are the base for the 39 Articles.
How much of a hoot did the Church of England as an institution give about Lutherans at the time? Were they sort of like, thanks for these great ideas, we'll make 39 articles now, goodbye? Or was it like, hello, friends, you know, come over anytime, we'll make a cup of tea? I mean, did they institutionally care at all about Lutherans, the Germans, the Swedes?
Well, actually, they had really good reason to care. And pretty much everybody had good reason to care because there were politics going on that were purely civil politics. But, you know, having relationships matters. In 1539, Henry sent a formal request and an ambassador to Germany asking to join what was called the Schmalkald League. So the Schmalkald League was Germany was divided. You had Lutheran princes and you had Roman Catholic princes, okay? And of course, the emperor who was over it all was Roman Catholic. And there was always a fear that the emperor would decide to use force to bring the Lutherans into line with the Roman Catholic Church. And probably the only reason that didn't happen is because he was too busy fighting the Turks and the French in alternating weekends. So the Lutheran princes decide by this point, we got to form our own military alliance, our own NATO. We're loyal subjects to the emperor until the emperor tries to suppress us, and then we'll be ready to fight. And Henry, he's got his own issues with France, and he's got his own issues with other powers. England wasn't in the strongest military position at the time, so he needs his own political allies, and now they're a Protestant state too, so why shouldn't the Protestants get together and be on the same page? So Henry asked to join the Schmalkald League, and the Schmalkald League's response was, we're very, very interested in this, but you actually have to sign the Augsburg Confession, because if we're going to have an alliance with religious basis, you've got to be full in with our religious system. Well, Henry wasn't into that, so that just never happened. We religious people, we look at the Reformation, we think it's only a religious thing. Oh, no, there's politics, geopolitics, there's economics. Everything's in play at the same time, and it's all interconnected in fascinating ways.
Today's episode is brought to you in part by the Poetry for All podcast. Poetry for All features award-winning teachers talking about poems. Poems that transform, enliven, challenge, enrich us. It opens the world of poetry to everyone through a simple approach. So in each episode, the host will read a poem, discuss it with a guest, and then they'll read it one more time. They take a stance of wonder toward each work while helping others into the many different experiences that a great poem might elicit. The podcast has thousands of listeners and a growing audience, and it covers classics like Shakespeare, Wheatley, and Whitman, alongside contemporary voices like poet laureate Ada Limón, Joy Harjo, and Carl Phillips. Whether you already love poetry or you're trying to figure it out for the first time, give it a listen. You can find Poetry for All wherever you get podcasts. Now, could we do a super crazy time turner fast forward? America, the Episcopal Church is here now. We've got a bunch of Lutherans here as well, coming from different immigrant groups. Different immigrant groups coming together, forming larger Lutheran bodies. The Episcopal Church as a branch of the Church of England, which becomes the Episcopal Church after the American Revolution. Still in communion with Canterbury. When did Lutherans and Anglicans or Episcopalians, when did they start approaching each other for full communion in the States? Like, why in the States did they pay attention to each other? What was the motive there for seeking full communion? Not just, you know, a common, you know, conversation, but actual full communion. Was that around World War I, like other ecumenical movements, or when did that happen?
Well, yeah, I noticed you jumped right over the 19th century in the Chicago Lambeth Quadrilateral, you know.
I did. I wanted to respect your time because I just noticed what time it was, but certainly dip in wherever you need to dip in.
No, you don't have to respect my time. I'm perfectly fine. I'm having more fun with this conversation than a lot of stuff I do.
Oh, great. Good.
To put it within context, Samuel Simon Schmucker, who was a Lutheran luminary in the early 19th century, and now who's generally vilified by most Lutherans, unjustly, I might add, called for something called the Fraternal Appeal. Fraternal Appeal with a plan for Catholic union upon apostolic principles. And he published that initially in 1838. The next version came out in 1839. That's the more important version. And it got republished two more times in various forms until 1872. And he called for all Protestant Christians to come together in the United States. Now, no, this is Protestant Christians, because he didn't think Catholics were really Christians, to be perfectly honest. So the call was
We've all got work to do.
Yeah, we've all got work to do. So he called for all Protestant Christians to come together. And when you look at his reason, his fundamental reason was mission and evangelism. He said, we have communities where there are no churches. And why are there no churches? Because we're spending all of our money competing with each other in the high population centers. So if we could stop competing with each other here, we could work together to put churches there in an expanding frontier. And that's not even to mention missionizing the Hindustans and the Mohammedans, as he called it, you know, all the other non-Christian religions, and also beating back the Roman Catholics. That was part of his program. So that was his dream. But that wasn't just his dream. You find there are Protestants all over the place that are really intent on this. And one of the big things is the International Missionary Conference in Madras, India. I think it was 1896, where they said our major obstacle to foreign missions is that we're on competing pages. We send Presbyterians come in 1 week and say, join our church. And then 2 weeks later, it's the Anglicans. And 2 weeks later, it's the Lutherans. And the people in these foreign countries we're going to are saying, well, why should I believe you? The last one who was here said this.
Yeah.
So that's the basis for the first Faith and Order conference that was held in the 20th century. Mm. So what's behind it is missionary work. Mm-hmm. So that brings us up to the 20th century. And it all tied into something known as the Christian Century movement. I know there's a publication called the Christian Century, but already in the late 1800s, they were talking about the 20th century was going to be the Christian Century.
Wow.
In which Christianity would finally spread throughout the entire globe and the world would become Christian. Mm. Yeah. You talk about that today and people get really nervous mm-hmm. because it sounds like triumphalism, because it was.
Yeah.
Okay. And so modern ecumenism is built out of that stuff, even if we don't talk about it. Hmm. But to fast forward, you know, Lutherans and Episcopalians and Anglicans and everybody else were part of the World Council of Churches early on, early members of it, big supporters of it. And then the big breakthrough in Lutheran Episcopalian relationships in the United States was the Interim Eucharistic Sharing Agreement of 1982. Where we formally and officially said it's okay for a Lutheran to receive communion in an Episcopalian church and an Episcopalian to receive communion in a Lutheran church.
Wow.
I remember that. I was a kid when that happened. I was 17. We all went down to the Episcopal Church to celebrate. We had a joint service.
Oh.
And they outlined procedures for it, that if you had a joint service, if it was in the Episcopal Church, the Episcopal priest presided at altar and the Lutheran preached, and vice versa. So there were guidelines on how to do it and everything. And that was 82. And then, of course, we had the Concordat proposal, which was voted on in 1997, and the Lutherans rejected it. The Episcopalians agreed it, and that would have been a full communion agreement. The Lutherans rejected it, and it got rejected by like 6 votes or something like that, you know, in our assembly. And then 2 years later, we signed the Call to Common Mission, which was the second try at that. The joke often was, if Lutherans and Episcopalians can't get together, we don't know who can, because we never anathematized each other. You know, Lutherans anathematized Anabaptists. Lutherans and Calvinists anathematized each other. Lutherans and Roman Catholics anathematized each other. I mean, Lutherans anathematized a lot of people, and we got anathematized a lot back. But that never happened between our two traditions.
Because you guys are so passionate. So, I mean, you guys are so passionate, you know, and we're Anglicans are like, order, order. But anyway, so we had our differences, but we never went head to head, basically.
We never went head to head. But here you get back to distinctives. And when you say Lutherans are passionate, the thing that really strikes me as different about Lutheranism is we're really a theological movement. I had a professor once who said that Lutheranism is a movement within the Church Catholic that has a proposal of dogma for the Church Catholic, that in some ways we're really asking for an 8th ecumenical council, where we're going to sit down and justification by grace through faith apart from works of the law is the question.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the thing that defines us technically is our confessional corpus, this theological corpus. It's not our worship form. It's not our polity. It's not our good works. It's not even the potluck and the coffee. Mm. It is these doctrinal propositions. And so we're passionate about that. We fight amongst ourselves about it, how to interpret it, and we fight with everybody else about it, which created some weirdness when Lutherans and Episcopalians were talking, because there were certainly some Lutherans who were saying, wait a second, what do Episcopalians believe?
Yeah.
And the answer, the Book of Common Prayer and the Episcopacy.
Yeah. Some Episcopalians asking themselves, what are the Lutherans getting so mad about?
Right. And of course, Episcopalians saying, what, you can use different worship forms? That makes no sense at all. We all have to worship the same way. And do you really have bishops? I know you have people who are called bishops, but they don't really look like bishops to us.
What do they do? Do they really work?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So in some respects, while we never anathematized each other, the fundamental structures, the meta structures of thought between the two traditions are radically different in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Eastern Orthodox Christians would call this the phronema, the mindset, the imaginary that we each are carrying with us.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we finally pulled it together with the Call to Common Mission, but that itself was not without some hiccups afterwards, because we had Lutheran pastors who were adamant that they would not submit to ordination by a bishop.
Hmm.
You know, by a Lutheran bishop. They wouldn't submit to that.
Hopefully they don't ordain themselves.
So, part of that goes all the way back to the Reformation, when the Lutheran Reformation in Germany was hot and heavy. Roman Catholic bishops wouldn't ordain candidates coming out of the Wittenberg University or anybody who subscribed to, quote unquote, the evangelical theology or the Wittenberg theology. So what Luther and others did said, well, we believe there's ample evidence from the church fathers that presbyteral ordination is sufficient, that presbyters can ordain other presbyters. And that happened. So then that raises the whole question of apostolic succession.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that was part of the big thing that was debated between Lutherans and Episcopalians in America. You know, that's why we changed our constitution to reinstate tactile apostolic succession.
Wow.
But there were others within the Lutheran fold who were like, that's imposing a necessity that is not actually a necessity. And then we get something called status confessionis, which all goes back to the fights of the Augsburg-Leipzig interim about what is really necessary and what's not necessary. So yeah, there's a whole chapter there that's really fascinating when you get into it. And you're right, this phronema, what is sort of your fundamental way of thinking about things influences that?
Yeah. Well, I wonder, Matthew, if we could spend the last 10 minutes of our conversation on some of the work that you've done, your role in Anglican-Lutheran relationships. You've been involved for quite a number of years, and you've done a lot of work on questions of church and state, work that you've done in ecumenical places, the work you've done in church polity and politics. I'm curious about this political moment in the United States, in our world, even in, you know, the Anglican communion and our different churches struggling with the splitting over different theological issues like human sexuality. I'm curious what we can learn from one another, from your experience, from what you've done, from what you've seen. What have you discovered that Anglicans might learn from Lutherans and that Lutherans might learn from Anglicans in our moment today?
So when we talk about full communion and talk about relationship, we talk about something called reception. And reception gets made in different ways in different places. And what I'm talking about is at the national level between the Episcopal Church and the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America as its church-wide expression. Reception is the adoption of these formal agreements that we have. And it is the continued coordination. For instance, there's a Lutheran Episcopal Coordinating Committee that is still meeting years after we got into full communion to work out ongoing questions and details. Like one of the big questions right now is mutual recognition of deacons, which we currently don't have. Reception at the synodical diocesan level is about me working with my counterpart here in West Virginia and Western Maryland, because I work with more than one Episcopal bishop because of the territory, in orderly transfer of clergy, cooperative venture. So like I have an Episcopal priest serving one of my congregations. I have a Lutheran pastor serving an Episcopal congregation. You know, this is stuff we do, and that's regulated at the diocesan level. And it is also something where we say, like I get on the phone, I call the canon for the diocese and I said, hey, I've got a vacant congregation here. What's your situation in that territory? Oh, we're vacant too. Can we call somebody together to cover this type of thing? You know, there's that. And also discipline. We work together on discipline because sometimes that happens across borders. And then local reception is when the local pastor and the local priest can actually work together and do things together. I had 6 fantastic years in my first call with a local Episcopal counterpart where we got to the point that we would sit down with our calendars and we would plan Advent and Lent together. That we would say, when are your special services? When are your special services? Let's make sure that we're not doing things at the same time so that we can offer to our people a wider palette of experience. Let's do this service that we would never do alone if it was only us, but together we can observe the Feast of the Ascension. Together we can observe all 7 days or 8 days of the Easter octave, that we can do Easter Vigil together. But you know what? One of the things I've learned through that is making this work at the local level is entirely dependent upon 2 things. The first and most important of them is the clergy. If they can't work together, if they can't have a good sense that they can be civil or even friends, nothing's going to happen. Because if the clergy is like protecting their territory, or they have a sense that they don't trust the other person, nothing's going to happen. That's the most important thing. The second thing is the people are actually willing to get out of the pew in their own building and go to a pew in somebody else's building. And we can't even get Lutherans to do that. So sometimes I wonder how we get ecumenical partners to do that.
It's hard to even just sit in a different seat in a different pew in your own building than it is
exactly.
Go to another church.
But I can tell you that it can happen. An example would be, I got home one time. This is the days before cell phones, and the phone was blinking. I picked it up, and they said that one of my parishioners was in the hospital and was dying. So I called the person who called me and said, we couldn't get a hold of you, so we called Father Judd, you know, who was my Episcopal counterpart. They called him. I wasn't available.
Wow.
They automatically defaulted to him because we had such a good working relationship. And he went to the hospital, and he took care of it for me. And I went up and caught up later. And then there was another time I got a call from the junior warden, and she said, you know, Father Bill, who was retired, was not doing well at the hospital, and Judd was away. She said, could you go and see? Absolutely, I can do that. Or there was a time where Father Judd got called away for an emergency, but he had a scheduled service. So he called me and said, can you go cover my service for me? You know, when you can have that type of close working relationship, these communion agreements are absolutely alive and do nothing but serve the people. They provide for the people better quality of pastoral care, yeah, and word and sacrament. And it's great. And so even if they don't necessarily actually cross congregational boundaries, when they see the priests and the pastors working together, they can have a sense that they're well cared for. Then diocesan stuff is all back office. Nobody thinks it's very sexy, but it's vitally important to making this stuff work. So that's what I've learned from Lutheran Episcopal relationships. Sometimes, as much as we like to focus on the big national stuff, the real strength is when it's on the ground, when it's in the church, when it's in the local community. And that is just a blessing when it happens.
When I ask you what Episcopalians and Lutherans can learn from one another in this moment, I love how you took it from the ideological level straight down to the ground. And the answer is something like, well, they can learn who each other's priests are and learn to trust them so that you can have an Episcopalian who knows the Lutheran priest well enough that calls them when they're sick. And that is just extraordinary. I've heard lots of beautiful stories about shared services, shared service projects, conversations, joint statements on things. I haven't heard enough stories yet, I think, about just what you're talking about. People knowing each other well enough and congregants knowing what other pastors are in the community that can serve them. The learning of mutual trust, I think, is beautiful. And the learning of mutual trust in our wider societies. And so the witness that gives, even if it's a small moment of someone being confused, I thought you were a Lutheran. Why is this Episcopal priest coming in here to your hospital room? Just that witness to what Christ prayed for so fervently, and I believe still prays for, which is the unity of his people, yeah, that the world might believe, and by believing be, you know, transformed by that love that doesn't make sense by any worldly standard. Doesn't make any sense to come together rather than follow the laws of entropy. So I'm hearing something quite grand in this very granular grassroots thing that you described.
One of the cornerstones of full communion agreements is the idea of interchangeability. And I don't know that we're ever really interchangeable until that day the parishioner says, I'm in trouble. I can't find my pastor. The Episcopalian is good enough, you know, or vice versa.
Yeah, yeah, totally. In some senses, that's where it starts, but in also some ways, that's kind of where it ends. Do you know what I mean?
We don't think about the term friendship as much as we would. If we all read Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, we would understand how important friendship is and how deep friendship can be. And to have that type of friendship amongst us across the denominations, it's not something you legislate, and it's not something abstract. It has to be embodied and concrete. You have to go out and make connection. And if you stop and think about it, if we start with the parish level, having these good relationships formally accepted, eventually those parish priests and pastors are going to become diocesan synodical officers, mm-hmm, eventually going to become bishops. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw what that looked like with the Roman Catholics because my first bishop here had been a pastor in the same town as a Roman Catholic priest, and they both became bishops. And you could see it when we were together that these two guys had a bond and connection that went back to their earliest days of parish ministry.
Yeah.
And I still get that. We have Larkham here, the Lutheran Anglican Roman Catholic United Methodist Tetralogue. And to go to that and to be able to know by name people of other tradition, to get there and say, hey, Ray, how are you doing? And raise a Roman Catholic deacon for all of our formal documents. And I am one who absolutely loves formal documents. I have an unnatural affection for Robert's Rules of Order.
You have boxes and boxes of them behind you.
Exactly. I mean, I collect old copies of Robert's Rules of Order. So I love this type of stuff. But you know what? It's when it becomes two hands clasping that it really becomes real.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I've been speaking today with the Most Reverend Matthew Lynn Riegel, Bishop of the West Virginia, Maryland Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Matt, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Absolutely, Amber. It's been a delight.
Thanks for tuning in to the Living Church Podcast, a ministry of the Living Church. In 2 weeks, join me for a chat with poet Kate Kilcup Marsh on life, writing, meeting Jesus in Orthodoxy, and becoming an Episcopal priest's wife. Until then, our producer is Leslie Thompson. I'm Amber Noel, your host, and it's been good to be with you. Peace.